This morning, we are going to start year two of the Old Testament study, and we're going to study 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 9 and 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 7. So we are going to go through those, I hope, in not too much detail, but in enough detail that you get a sense of what's going on. It's basically impossible to cover 1 Chronicles in any sort of way where you're going to get to any level of detail. You have to start to pull out kind of what are the themes that the writer was attempting to convey. And again, I subtitled this Generations of the Faithful and Unfaithful, because what you'll see in both the 1 Chronicles passage, or I'm sorry, in the 1 Chronicles passages and the 1 Samuel passages, is that there are examples of both faithful and unfaithful people. And so it's a great example and a great admonishment for us to consider those things. And using that as a segue, if you would pull out your, or just open up, if you've already put it in your binder, to your summary sheet. This is one that just says summary, 1 Chronicles and 1 Samuel at the top. I'm just going to do a quick read through this, because what this does is it starts to set the kind of what we can expect. It sets the expectation of what the writer was trying to achieve when he was writing and those things. So let me read through this. Hopefully you've got yours right in front of you. 1 and 2 Chronicles. The books which we have in our Bibles as 1 and 2 Chronicles were actually one book up until the time that the Greek Old Testament translation, or the Septuagint, was compiled around 200 B.C. The title had originally, and inaccurately, originally been the omitted things, which reflected the fact that they believed the book contained material not in 1 and 2 Samuel and in 1 and 2 Kings. The title Chronicles originated with the Latin Vulgate translation around 400 A.D. Neither book contains any direct statement about who the human author of these scriptures was, though the Jewish tradition indicates Ezra the priest. The closest estimate of when these books were compiled is circa 450 to 430 B.C. The historical setting, then, for these books is the return of the Jewish exiles from 70 years of captivity, which was around 538 B.C. However, the land they returned to was significantly different, with no Hebrew king, but instead a Persian governor, with no security, because again, as I state later, the wall had been knocked down, city had been in ruins, so there was no security for the people there. There was no temple, no political or military power, little to no wealth, and very few divine blessings beyond the fact that they had returned to the land. Additionally, God's presence no longer dwelt amongst them as it had when the temple had been located in their midst. They no doubt felt very alone, and their future looked bleak. The chronicler's selective genealogy and history of Israel was therefore intended to remind the Jews of God's promises and intentions about, first of all, the land, second of all, the nation, third of all, the Davidic line, fourth, the priests of the Levites, fifth, the temple, and sixth, true worship, none of which had been annulled because of their being taken into captivity. Overall, then, the book was written to encourage them to be faithful, even in these troubling times. So we face very troubling times ourselves, and certainly we know how that can shake your confidence, it can shake your faith. And these Jews and what they returned to faced even worse. And certainly the chronicler, which I'll touch on, repeatedly is stating certain things, especially as he gets into some of the later genealogies, to help remind them that there is a hope for the future. Additionally, for the summary of 1 and 2 Samuel, it says, similar to 1 Chronicles, 1 and 2 Samuel were also considered one book in the early Hebrew manuscripts, but were later broken into two books by the translators of the Septuagint. However, the title of these books has always contained the reference to Samuel. Wasn't called something else. It was always Samuel or 1 and 2 Samuel. While Jewish tradition stated that the author of these books was Samuel, or Samuel and Nathan and Gad, it is not possible because Samuel's death is recorded in 1 Samuel 25:1 before the events associated with David's reign even took place. The author, therefore, is unknown. Additionally, the time of the writing of the books is unclear. However, due to several factors, it has been determined that it was most likely penned before the exile during the divided kingdom, and therefore could have been written any time in the 931 to 722 B.C. time frame. The majority of what is recorded in 1 and 2 Samuel takes place in and around the central highlands of Israel. And these events, which are recorded, actually took place between 1105 BC, around the birth of Samuel, and 971 BC, which are the last words of David. Therefore, there's about a 135-year period described in the narratives. There are four primary themes to 1 and 2 Samuel: the Davidic covenant, including the promise of the Christ, the sovereignty of God, the work of the Holy Spirit divinely empowering men for service, and the personal and national effects of sin. Which is why I kind of noted as we started, let us listen closely as we study these books for these applications for our lives. That is going to be one of the things I think you'll see repeated in here. It's been a theme that we've seen throughout the Old Testament narratives we studied, of faithful men who accomplished what God had called them to accomplish. Especially, again, I think of, probably because I taught it, I think of Joshua. And I think of a man who just set his mind to do exactly what it was that the Lord had said. He had seen examples of what disobedience and disbelief and lack of fidelity to the Lord had caused in the 40 years of wilderness wandering. And he was determined he was going to walk faithfully. And so we will see examples of both types of people in these narratives as we go through them. So, all that being said, let me jump to the first slide. This gives you, again, this is in your binders. I'm not going to take a great deal of time on this, but this is kind of where we've been from Genesis and the beginnings, covenants and generations of the first people to Ruth, which was just covered recently, on the idea of what a kinsman redeemer was. So we have been through that. Now where are we going? Excuse me. We're going essentially to the two main events that are going to happen here. First of all, the monarchy, which was instituted around 1051 BC, and then the recording of the monarchy, and then the divided kingdom, which happened around 931 BC. So that's a kind of a good summary of where we're going to land this year, but again, in your binders are an even better summary. So where we are today, what are we going to be studying today? We're going to be studying 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 9, which essentially, Chronicles, again, is a selective genealogies. Not every person who was in those lines will always be listed there. But we will go through the ones who are listed there so that we can get an idea of who the chronicler was trying to point to, what his understanding was. So, again, we'll break that up into Adam to just before Judah, and then the 12 tribes, and we'll cover the chronicles or the genealogies of those 12 tribes, and then finally end up with those people who were dwelling in Jerusalem. And then as we cover 1 Samuel, chapters 1 through 7, you can see some of the topics there, Samuel's birth, as we've talked about, faithfulness rewarded, wickedness judged, grace promised, and several other items that finally ends up with repentance and mercy. So I think that's a great way to cover 1 Samuel, chapters 1 through 7, and 1 Chronicles, chapters 1 through 9. However, yes, folks, that's 16 chapters worth of stuff. So we are going to move at a relatively breakneck pace. I am fine to stop and ask for questions, but you may not get the rest of the story depending on how long we talk. So just wanted to let you know we've got a lot to cover today. Okay, so first of all, 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 9. Essentially, as you get in, and by the way, at the top of your question and answer sheets, and do you have an extra one? Q&A sheet right here. Okay. Let me just quickly read the theme. While varying in the times written, what was discussed and their ultimate purposes, 1 Chronicles and 1 Samuel record the history of both the faithful who are rewarded for their faith and their trust as they trust, believe, and obey in the Lord. And alternatively, both also present a record of judgment which results in infidelity against the Lord. And the memory verse there was a lot of material, obviously, to cover here. But one of the ones that really stuck with me was one of the last, or essentially the last chapter of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 7:3 says, "Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, 'If you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines.'" So again, this tied to the fact that it is not just what we'll see in 1 Samuel is actually this bogus belief the Israelites had that somehow the Ark of the Covenant was just a magic charm. It was a talisman of some kind. Instead, what we see here in this verse is that what the Lord really wants is our obedience and our hearts, more so than just, you know, kind of fealty to doing what he says, but also that we would love and obey him, not just out of duty, but out of the fact that we love him. So, all that being said, so I have here the selective genealogies of Adam to pre-Judah. So what you see is it says Adam, and then it has an arrow to the right, and then it has an S and a blank. You may have already picked this up, but if you look at that slide, you'll see a lot of things in, I guess it's gold if I look on my slide master. It looks more yellow to me, but that's fine. You'll see a lot of things in yellow. That's going to be your key as to what to fill out. Either something will be underlined in yellow or it'll be highlighted in a box like this, and you're going to be seeing a lot of boxes because these are genealogies. So I wanted to make sure that you kind of understood the flow of what's going on. So let me just kind of fill out this first row here. You have Adam on the first line, obviously. Then you have Seth. Then Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, and Noah. So we end up on that first, and again, this is where essentially 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 ends up. It ends up going from Adam to Noah. So as we continue on, you're only going to get two on here, and I hope you can see those. I knew it was going to be kind of small, but to actually fit in a lot of the names that it was mentioning, it kind of necessitated to make the type small. But essentially what you see is Noah, whose sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. What's interesting is you actually go through the narrative is that while Shem is mentioned first, they actually then go to Japheth and give the rundown of his descendants, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javai, Tubal, and Meshach, and Tyrus. Then they move over to Ham and go to his descendants, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And then they move over to Shem, which you'll see on the next slide. The idea there is that you give prominence towards the one who comes at the last, and that's the line that you want to continue to follow. It's also, I think, frankly, easier from a narrative point of view that if that's the line you intend to follow, then it's easier to bring that one up last. So what's interesting, I thought, from this slide is just that you see Mizraim spawned a lot of different people groups, including the Philistines, off to kind of the right there. And then Canaan, obviously, that phrase is very familiar. We've heard it before in our studies. Gave us the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, Arvadites, Zemarites, and Hamathites. And I'll take another drink of coffee after saying all those. So there, those are people groups who we are going to run into, I think, again and again. All right, your next slide here is also starts giving you a little bit more to do again. So as you look at this progression from Noah, you see Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We've covered Ham and Japheth on the previous slide. Shem had five sons, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. And while, again, some of the individual other genealogies are broken out, especially like Joktan, as you can see there, the line that we wanted to follow here, because, again, the chronicler is driving towards specific individuals, and you'll see that pattern as we go through this. So essentially, it's going from Noah to Shem. So again, on your sheets, that's Noah, Shem, Arphaxad, Selah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, and finally Abraham. So you get the sense. Okay, so now he's gone from Adam to Noah. He's now gone from Noah all the way to Abraham. So where might he go next? Well, he's going to go from obviously Abraham to Isaac. And we'll cover that in just a minute, but that's just give you a heads up, that's where we're going next. But we also have Ishmael, who had those children Ishmael, whose mother was Hagar, and then Ishmael's various children there, interestingly enough, also 12 children. And then you have, and I just did this really for for an interest of space. All of these children off to the right there, Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua, are all children of Keturah, who was Abraham's wife after Sarah had died. But continuing to go through these genealogies, we have the descendants of Abram or Abraham. Here now we see one more being revealed. Obviously, I think you already knew this one, but Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, or Jacob. But then the various other children there, including all those children of Esau. Those boxes that are kind of dark blue at the bottom there, they were a kind of an aside within the text that linked this family of Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Dishon, and Ezer to Timnah. These are relatives of Timnah. So I didn't know exactly how to display that, so I chose that way to do it. In the next section, 1 Chronicles 1, verses 43 to 54, you see some of the kings or chiefs of Edom here, and I'm really not going to get into any detail on this other than to just say that these leaders were likely listed here because the relationship of the Edomites to Israel and Judah was so close and of such long duration. So again, the chronicler is trying to recreate for a lot of these people who may have never been taught or have forgotten some of these genealogies where this was going. So, we're primarily most of the way through some of the basic initial genealogies, but what I wanted you to see here, and what you'll see actually as we go through the rest of the slides on First Chronicles, is why I take more time on some and less time on others. If you look at the actual number of verses that covers the genealogies of each of these tribal groups, what you'll see is that Judah has the most verses at 110 verses. Levi has the second most at 81, and Benjamin has the third most at 47. And essentially, they, between the three of them, almost 75% of the content of 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 9 is talking about one of those three groups. Some of the likely reasons for that are that these three remained faithful to the king in Jerusalem. They did not, actually a part of Benjamin split off, but not the entire group. A lot of Benjamin remained faithful, but certainly Judah remained faithful, and Levi, the priest, remained faithful. So that's potentially another reason, or a reason why they would have gotten greater space played out. Also, because of Judah's kingly, in other words, David, and his line, Judah's kingly and Levi's priestly heritage, they're probably covered a little bit more in detail. And on this slide, you'll start to see really where the chronicler, as he's gone now through the whole chapter 1 and now we're going through chapter 2, where he's trying to drive to. So you see, and this will be your next set of blanks to fill out. You have Israel or Jacob, then begetting Judah, Judah begetting Perez or Tamar, depending on where it is within the scriptures. Then Hezron, Perez begetting Hezron, Hezron begetting Ram, Ram begetting Amminadab, Amminadab begetting Nahshon, Nahshon begetting Salma or Salmon, again depending on where it's listed, Salmon begetting Boaz, and of course now we're getting into what we studied last week. And we have Boaz begetting Obed, or essentially Obed being Boaz's son. Then we see Jesse is Obed's son, and of course, who's the son of Jesse that we know so well? David, King David. So you see these various families listed here, and it's very interesting. If you start to look at these, as I started to look at them, what you really start to see is the effect of faithfulness within your own family as it goes down through generations, or unfaithfulness as it goes down through generations of families, and the blessing that can bring, or the curse that can bring. And it's very interesting, as you study these genealogies, you start to see that more and more. And again, I think that's probably another example how that ties into the idea of the faithfulness is rewarded by God. So, what's interesting here to note, though, is that Judah is listed first in these genealogies, because though Reuben was the firstborn, his sin with Jacob's concubine, his sexual sin with Jacob's concubine, essentially put him under Jacob's curse, and therefore he is really relegated to kind of one of the lesser talked about tribes. Also, the focus is on David's throne. That's one of your blanks there. The focus is it's in that same area where some of these arrows and fill in the blanks are. So the focus is on David's throne and the hope of reestablishing it someday. As you can see in verse 2 of chapter 2, from him came the leader, this idea that he's pointing towards David. And again, he's writing to people who had been in exile. One of the things that they have a hope of is that someday there will be a king. And obviously the promised king is the ultimate fulfillment of that, Christ, who will rule on the throne of David forever. So some things I didn't chart here, you just get to a point with some of this that if I charted everything, there's no way we would ever get through the materials we had to cover today. So I didn't cover the sons of David's daughters, who were Zeruiah and Abigail in verses 16 and 17, the sons of Segub in verses 21 through 24, and some other things in some other verses. What's interesting, though, is in one of the things I didn't cover, in Caleb's descendants, Bethlehem is noted in verses 51 and 54. And it says it was founded or named after Caleb's great-grandson through Caleb's wife, Ephrathah. Which, of course, you see, and where do we hear that? Where do we hear Bethlehem of Ephrathah? Two places, at least. Think cold. Think end of the year. Yeah. When Herod had the children killed, and it said this is, you know, what was talked about, Bethlehem of Ephrathah. So just thought I'd bring that up as you can start to see where some of these names come up in the genealogies. I'll do that with some other names as we go through. Especially I'll try to focus on the people, in fact, who we're going to start to talk about in 1 Samuel.
Wasn't Zeruiah his sister? Because she was the mother of Joab and Abishai and
Bethel,
right?
You know, I would need to go back and look. I would have to say, the one thing that I ran across as you went through these genealogies is that there can be a lot of changing of names that occurs. There's actually, I mean, as you've seen in some of the other ones, Selma, it's called Salmon. So I think what I'm trying to do is just establish kind of the flow as I saw it presented in going through those various names. So I'll check them. Okay. So, obviously, we're driving down to David. And then in chapter 3, verses 1 through 9, you see the continued unveiling of the line of Judah through the descendants of David. So you have the list of sons there, of which there are, I believe, 19 sons there. Obviously, Solomon is the one that will be keyed off of, though, again, really, once he gets to David, that's one of the people he really wanted to highlight. But I did note, if you can read any of those, the descendants of Solomon in the pre-exilic period all the way down to Josiah and Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin and Zedekiah. So I didn't cover the exilic and post-exilic names in there, because then I figured this is really leading now to the time where they went into exile. But again, those names are there because he's wanting to tie together, you know, these are the lines that these people came from. There's some people who you may even know today as you go through some of these various names, not obviously these in the pre-exilic names, but who will, you know, have come from these family lines. So, as we get to 1 Chronicles chapters 4 and 5, and especially as we get to Simeon in verse 42 of chapter 4, one of the commentators that I read on this, he called some of these the tribes that are easily forgotten. So, obviously, the big three that we've talked about already are ones that are going to be maybe a little bit more... One, they're going to need more information about because of the kingly line and the priestly line, but also just because they were probably a little bit better known. But now, as we take a look at this next section, I didn't finish the families of Judah here just again because it would have taken up a lot of time, and I think the narrative really starts to go into, you know, who are these other tribes in Israel? So we have, first of all, Simeon, which is covered in chapter 4, verses 24 through 43. And it's likely listed after Judah because it's received no tribal allotment and eventually was assimilated into Judah. So they naturally made sense to list together. Then you see the Transjordan tribes in chapter 5, verses 1 through 26. First of all, of Reuben in verses 1 through 10. And the chronicler notes that Reuben was listed after Judah because Reuben forfeited his firstborn privileges, as I had talked about previously. But the chronicler also takes pains to note, and in fact you'll see that in a number of these, as he talks about a number of these tribes, he shows that there are benefits, even to maybe a tribe like Reuben that had this curse, but there are benefits in terms of maybe military prowess in the past, or the fact that they had settled certain lands and other facts like that. So he does take pains to point out that eventually they want to see the land of Israel repopulated with all of the tribes. That maybe all of the tribes weren't there at that time, but that all of the tribes are welcome back into Israel. Next, we see Gad in chapter 5, verses 11 through 17, that lived adjacent to Reuben, and like Reuben, played a minor role in the Davidic kingdom. And then in verses 18 through 22, we see the narrative of the Transjordan victory. And then there's the narrative, it talks about the half-tribe of Manasseh, and then the narrative of defeat and deportation of Manasseh. Those two narratives are there for, again, a very specific reason. The narrative of the Transjordan victory in verses 18 through 22 is to point out that fidelity to God can lead to victory. You know, again, the idea that as you are faithful to God, God will be faithful to you. Whereas you see the half tribe of Manasseh, where it's interesting, it doesn't even list its descendants, but just calls them numerous, that they were unfaithful to God at a certain time, and it's a contrast to, again, 15:18 through 22, and that infidelity can lead to bondage. So again, it's this idea that you know, those rules, quote unquote, you know, aren't necessarily hard and fast. God is merciful and doesn't always punish us for our sin, and sometimes He takes us through time of trial, and we wonder if He's really blessing us. But overall, as you are faithful, God will be faithful, and you'll see that pattern through your life. If you are unfaithful, He will at some point turn His back on you or bring you into discipline. And so this is, again, another one of those narratives that is used to show that fact. As we move into 1 Chronicles chapter 6 into Levi, we're now getting in, again, the second largest section of narrative after Judah. It talks about essentially the priestly clan. And so in verses 1 through 15, what you see here is the high priestly line distinguished in verses 1 through the first part of verse 4. So the chronicler distinguishes the high priest from the other descendants of Levi. So you have this true line of high priests that came from Levi through Kohath, through Amram, through Aaron, through Eleazar, and through Phinehas. And that's one of your blanks here. The high priestly line continued in verse 4 through 15. The chronicler concentrates on the descendants of Eleazar and Phinehas as the only valid high priestly line. So again, he's trying to establish or reestablish, really, for these returning Israelites, the priestly line, the Davidic line, so that they know essentially that God still is overlooking these things. So 1 Chronicles chapter 6, as we get into the latter part of the chapter, verses 16 through 47, it talks about quote-unquote ordinary Levites. That's what the commentator that I was looking at used, and I thought that was a good description because it talks about Levites who perform their jobs from day to day. But it's interesting to note that Elkanah and his son Samuel are mentioned here. So obviously now we're starting to tie in to what we're going to study a little bit later, which is the study of 1 Samuel. So, the MacArthur Study Bible notes that Samuel, by exceptional divine direction, offered priestly sacrifices. Usually, that was not the job of an ordinary, quote-unquote, priest. And also the Bible Knowledge Commentary I used said that Samuel could not function as a high priest but could officiate at the tabernacle and perform other ministries, which evidently included sacrifice. So there was a way, I mean, MacArthur believes that there was a way in which Samuel was given divine direction to offer sacrifices. So that covers the ordinary Levites in verses 16 through 30. And then we get to the Levitical musicians in verses 31 through 47. So 31 notes that these are those whom David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord and their descendants. So these families served, as we see in verse 32, in David's tabernacle and in Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. Additionally, what it's interesting here that we see in verse 39 that a descendant of these people was Asaph. And of course, where do we see Asaph later in the Bible? Psalms. That's right. A lot of the Psalms were written by Asaph. So again, tying together who some of these folks were. And on that, descendant flowchart, whatever you would make it, I just noted kind of the line of Asaph, and then obviously the line of Levi that ended up in Samuel. And again, this is one of those places where you have Elkanah and Samuel, and it's not entirely clear where the connections are there. So I kind of drew a dotted line, but eventually that line does go down to Samuel. There may be more than one Elkanah in that line. And finally, in chapter 6, so again, as I mentioned, we would cover some of these in more detail. You see the duties of the priests in verses 48 through 53. So the priestly responsibilities essentially were to do all that Moses had commanded. And then the priestly leadership we see outlined in verses 50 through 53. And the chronicler notes which families were high priests in charge of all the other sons of Aaron. So you see some detailing of that high priestly line, so that can become familiar again to the Israelites. And then finally, in verses 54 through 81, you see the lands for Levi's descendants. So again, we talked about the cities that the Levites were to be, and the areas that the Levites were to be given. So a couple things of interest to note there, that most sites were outside post-exilic Judah. So they were outside the land that they had come back to inhabit. So, again, if you think about the purpose of the chronicler, this is a expression of hope to regain those lost territories at some time. And then it's also instruction to the tribes to remember their responsibilities of the provision of this land to the Levites when that would come about. So that's a dual purpose of hope and also, you know, saying, hey, remember, this is not all your land. These lands were designated for the Levites. And then finally, we get to 1 Chronicles chapter 7. So we're almost there. It's chapter 7, and we're getting closer to chapter 9. So we go to another set of other tribes easily forgotten. So what you see in the narrative is that you see the narrative of Judah. You see this list of tribes easily forgotten. Then you see Levi, see another set of tribes easily forgotten. And then you see more about Benjamin at the end. So first of all, Issachar, the focus was on many, in verse 4, many wives and children, or the blessing of those many wives and children. And then verse 2, the idea of fighting men, which again would be welcome for post-exilic growth. Again, he's saying, you know, we want to welcome all these people back to Israel, and here are some of the reasons why we should. Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, and this is believed to be the tribe of Benjamin that actually went and to the tribes of the north at the splitting of the kingdom. And it introduces, and one of the reasons it is so, because these other tribes actually were believed to have gone north. So Benjamin is, they feel this part of Benjamin being listed here. There's a whole other set of verses, in fact, a whole almost another chapter that talks about Benjamin. They believe that's really talking about the people who remained faithful, and this is talking about the people who left. But it introduces Benjamin's sons and descendants and is primarily focused on fighting men. Again, the idea of welcoming these people back in for what they can do for the country overall. Finally, just one verse on Naphtali. In verse 13, so even though he was a child of Jacob's concubine Bilhah, commentator noted here that the idea that the chronicler may have been trying to get across was that he still belonged to the people of God, the descendants still belong to the people of God, so not to look down on them. And then we have, as we go up to the tribe of Manasseh here, now this talks about the half-tribe west of the Jordan as opposed to east of the Jordan. So again, Manasseh was split into two tribes. One went to the west of the Jordan, one went to the east of the Jordan. So this is talking about the tribe on the west side. The main purpose is to indicate the rightful place of the Manassehites among the people of God, and the chronicler reaffirms the property rights of women. Interesting, we had talked about this several months ago, really now, but reaffirms the property rights of women by the prominent mention of several women in the passage, including Zelophehad's daughters, which is the passage that we kind of focused on and said, and Dwight's been very good to explain how that all works. But again, he's trying to reinforce these things to a people who may not have heard about these or have forgotten about them. Then as we go down to Ephraim, verses 20 through 29, the focus is on Joshua, who was an Ephraimite, and it calls attention to the military possibilities, the military prowess perhaps that is available in his line. An additional focus in verses 28 and 29 is on the land, likely to prompt hope of a future reacquisition. It's a focus on the land that the Ephraimites controlled. And then finally, Asher in verses 30 through 40, really focusing on the genealogy, reminder of the genealogy and the fighting skills of the people from Asher. So, almost done. Chapter 8, again, I've talked about the fact we would get to Benjamin. Here, Benjamin is one of the other big three that is noted in these chronicles. And so it talks about the Benjamites in kind of really various locations is what the various sections focus on. The first section, verses 1 through 7, talks about Geba, which is 8 miles north-northeast of Jerusalem, and was repossessed early in the post-exilic period, and also focuses on Benjamin's grandson, Ehud, the judge who brought victory over the Moabite king, Eglon. So you can see the idea there, the reacquisition of property, the leading in military matters. So there's a definite reminder there for the people about the Benjamites. Also, these other geographic areas mentioned, Moab, Ono, Lod, Ajalon, and Gath, are really tied to Elpal, the person. That's a person, Elpal, E-L-P-A-A-L, who is first talked about in, or who's talked about later in verse 12. And the descendants ties these geographic places to Benjamin. So Ono and Lod were built by Elpal's descendants, and Ajalon and Gath were occupied by Benjamites. So again, it's kind of reinforcing the idea that a place had been settled by somebody, showed growth, it showed the increase in population, and also that Ajalon and Gath had been occupied shows again military prowess. And indicates that Benjamin, it talks about Benjamite property rights and hopes for reclaimed lands. Verses 14 through 28, the Benjamites in Jerusalem. Now, this is interesting because what you start to see is this focus towards Jerusalem now. You've seen it even in some of these geographic areas that have been mentioned in terms of the Benjamites. And it says, these were heads of the fathers' households according to their generations, chief men who lived in Jerusalem. So these were faithful Benjamites during the divided kingdom who likely have moved to Jerusalem or living very closely to it on an annex. And then finally we see, as we're wrapping up the Benjamites, as the chronicler is wrapping up talking about the Benjamites and their genealogies, we see more Benjamites associated with Jerusalem. So we see Jael, the father, or founder, really. It says father in the NASB, but the idea is that he's the father in terms of he's the founder of Gibeon, which is 7 miles northwest of Jerusalem, and descendants who eventually lived with their relatives in Jerusalem. So it's kind of, again, starting to focus more and more towards Jerusalem. And finally, the latter half of it talks about the descendants and inhabitants of Jerusalem, who names that we would understand and remember, perhaps. Saul, the first king of Israel, Saul's father Kish, Saul's son Jonathan, Jonathan's son, which is shown here as, again, this is one of those places. It's Merib Baal, and we would, it's used other places as Mephibosheth. So, and then it talks further about Mephibosheth's line and some of the other people who lived in the Jerusalem area. So, finally, we are at chapter 9 of First Chronicles. And This may not be the most exciting stuff in the world, but what you start to see is the purpose of why the chronicler wrote, the faithfulness of people and God's faithfulness to them for being faithful to him is really what's being pointed out here. But as we get to chapter 9, we kind of get to the who, what, and why here. Who are the representatives from all tribes of Israel who had or would return? And it talks about this kind of what. It's the idea that Judah was carried away into exile, and why it was for their unfaithfulness. That's a very big focus. The idea, again, continues to be a very big focus. The unfaithfulness of Judah is what caused their exile. And that's an admonishment for the future post-exilic Israelites to remember what had happened to Judah. He, even though at one time was the most faithful and the most rock-solid of all of the Israelites, turned to away from the Lord, and the Lord turned away from them. So, and then also talks about some general returnees, but it gets into some specific returnees. The general returnees are kind of groups of people. The specific returnees, the people returning, in verses 3 through 34, it breaks down into the laity, the priests, and the Levites. So it has different genealogies for various groups there. And then, as I mentioned, it talks about Saul, it finally wraps up in chapter 9 with Saul's ancestry and his descendants. So you see the line through Jael there to Ner, to Kish, to Saul, and then finally from Jonathan down to Mephibosheth and others. So these are pre-exilic. It covers both pre-exilic and post-exilic, and it depends on how much it covers. You know, the chronicler was really trying to reach specific purposes for specific groups, but it will cover in most cases both pre-exilic and post-exilic. No. This is actually being written after that whole period, and it's being written in a time where those events have happened. And in fact, you know, again, a lot of what they're reflecting on here is that was unfaithfulness to the Lord that allowed the exodus to occur. Exile to occur. Thank you, William. And so he's saying, you know, those are things. He's essentially pointing to the fact: don't repeat those things. In fact, you know, we. Coming back to a land, as we mentioned in the introduction, that has been decimated, that is no longer anything like it was before. They're going to have to rebuild a lot of what had been there previously, of what the Lord had blessed them with. Pardon me? Describe the land? No. Think of Jerusalem. Jerusalem used to be this beautiful city with a wall around it that was one of the most defensible places in the whole area. It had the temple that was, you know, more gorgeous than what Herod built. And all of these things have now been destroyed. I mean, you're going to see Ezra come back and talk about, you know, or Nehemiah having to rebuild the wall and essentially reestablish Jerusalem as a city and have all the people come back from exile. So there had, when I say there was a destruction, it's essentially destruction of the structures and the social structures as well as the building infrastructure that had been there.
But this is the chronicler in Babylon flashing back the exilic Jews and just retelling their story.
Or the chronicler really in Jerusalem. Flashing back and retelling. There's flashback, but he also, some of the names that are discussed here are people who were post-exile. Obviously, it can't be anything. Well, it could be in the future, but it's not necessarily here. So, but it is talking both pre-exilic and post-exilic. Okay. Now we're to 1 Samuel, chapters 1 through 6. Which I will cover in probably very quick fashion, but hopefully we'll get a sense of where the narrative is going. Brian, I believe, is teaching next week, he'll pick this up and continue with it. So we see William.
Is there a fill-in sheet for this part? Because I don't have one. Some sheets only print one side.
Some sheets only print one side. I have a two-sided one. Well, Then you can just sit back and listen. Well, I'll tell you what. We have been going through a lot of history, a lot of names, a lot of facts. How about we actually read the Bible for a little bit here? So it'd be nice to touch base and study the Bible in a Bible class. So let's go ahead and I will read. I'm going to read verses 1-8 of chapter 1 of 1 Samuel. Now there was a certain man from Ramath-Zophim from the hill country. Again, we talked about the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah. We've heard that name before too. Now, so I think that's the reason that we grouped 1 Chronicles and 1 Samuel together, is it starts to give you a lead in to what's going on in 1 Samuel. Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other Penaniah. And Penaniah had children, but Hannah had no children. So what you see here is Elkanah's problem. He has two wives, only one with children. We've seen that pattern before. Who have we seen that pattern before with? Sarah, yeah, Rachel, yeah. It's a bad thing. But Elkanah, it's interesting. It points out that Elkanah was actually a pretty loving husband, and actually probably was relatively, maybe not rich, but relatively well-to-do. The fact he could support multiple wives. So I'm not taking that any farther than what I just did. He had two wives, and we talked about that. Verse 3, now this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, a little bit of foreshadowing there, were priests to the Lord there. When the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Penaniah, his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. It happened year after year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, I'm sorry, I'm going to laugh when I read this. Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? There's a believe Christian comedian out there, his name escapes me for right now, but he sings a song about the things that you never say to your wife. And I think this probably should have been in that list of things that you never say to your wife. So essentially now he's got two problems. He's got two wives, but only one with children, but he has two wives, but only one who's truly loved. So we've seen that situation before as well. So, and children are loved to your blanks for the people who have blanks, and my apologies about that. As we go in on to Hannah's petition and promise in verses 9 through 18, we start to see, obviously, how Samuel starts to come into this mix. Verse 9 says, then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She, greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but you will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come unto his head. So obviously it's talking about some form of Nazarite vow there. But really, it's also the main point here is that she's saying, Lord, give me a son, and I will completely give him over to you. You know, that's a great example, frankly, for us who are parents. It has become more and more apparent to me lately that I only have my children for a short period of time. They are really not mine. And in fact, my job is to, one, and as much as it is under my control, lead them to the Lord, and secondly, to raise them in a way that they will honor him. And because pretty soon, I've got a 16-year-old daughter now, she is going to be off on her own, and all I can do at that point is pray. And give advice and probably money, but you know, it really is apparent more and more so that our children are not our own; they are given to us for a time. But anyway, so Hannah's petition and promise, she lifts a desperate cry. And as we see in the next section, which I won't read, Eli misunderstands. She's sitting there crying, just kind of either whispering or just not saying anything. And he thinks she's drunk. So he said, how can you be drunk? And she says, no, this is the wish that I have. And in verses 17 and 18, his response to that is, then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. She said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So obviously, she felt that the Lord had heard her petition. And Eli encouraged her, in fact, in that process. So she leaves, as I have here, in grace and trust, trust being the underlying word. So we see in God's provision, eventually we see that her and her husband come together, and in fact they conceive, and Samuel is born in verses 19 through 20. So then we see further in verses 21 through 28 that he is prepared, and then Hannah follows through on her commitment and actually delivers Samuel to Eli to be in his service, to be in the service of the Lord. Chapter 2. So, titled this, Faithfulness Rewarded, Wickedness Judged, and Grace Promised. So, we won't take the time again because it's 20 after now and I'm running out of time, but we won't take the time to cover the reward of Hannah's heart or her praise that she offers in verses 1 through 10, but I just think it's interesting that she starts out, then Hannah prayed and said, my heart exalts in the Lord. It's very familiar to what Mary said in almost the same words. So anyway, she praises the Lord in verses 1 through 10. Verses 11 through 17 talk about the wicked sons of Eli. Now, Eli obviously was in this position of leadership, and yet he had two sons that were disobedient, who had relations with the women who were at the gates of the temple. And people knew of these things, these wicked things that they did. He knew of these things and obviously did not put a stop to it in some sort of way. He may have said, you shouldn't do that. And we'll talk about, he actually does confront them a little bit later, but not in a way that would really stop them from doing it. So we also see, though, the contrast of the faithful son and the mother's faithfulness physically rewarded. So we see more about Samuel here. And why don't we read verses 18 through 21. Says, she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. Verse 26. I think I put the wrong verse in there. I like how Dwight said last week that he had some technical problems with his slides. So that must be my technical problem with my slides this week. She said, oh, my Lord, send your, as your soul lives, my Lord, I'm the woman who stood here beside you praying. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition. So obviously, not only has she been rewarded in that, but she will also be rewarded with further children as we go through the narrative. So we see actually a wayward father warned in chapter 2, verses 22 through 25. That's what I was getting wrong. So it says, now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel and how they lay with the woman who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He said to them, why do you do such things, the evil things that I hear from all these people? No, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. So obviously the Lord had intended what he was going to do here. And again, we talked about in Samuel that one of the themes is the sovereignty of God in Samuel, and you certainly see the Lord playing out that sovereignty here. So, a judgment proclaimed is this next section. I mean, verse 26 talks about the boy Samuel was growing in stature and in favor with both the Lord and men, but 27 goes on and says, then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, thus says the Lord, did I not intend to reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt in bondage to Pharaoh's house? Did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar? And he goes on and talks about various other priestly duties. Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore, the Lord God of Israel declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. You will see the distress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I will do for Israel, and an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will not cut off every man of yours from my altar, so that your eyes will fail from weeping and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life. This will be the sign to you which will come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day, both of them will die. But he's also faithful, and he says, But I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed ways. So it continues on. So a judgment is proclaimed here. It says Hophni and Phinehas are going to die, and they're going to die on the same day. But also we see in this next section, as I titled it here, the grace is promised. So, finally, as we get into chapter 3 and a little bit into chapter 4 here, I'll just kind of summarize this here. God speaks to a confused Samuel. Essentially, Samuel is sleeping in the temple with Eli down the hall or something like that. And God comes and says, Samuel. And so Samuel wakes up and he thinks it's Eli. So he goes down to the hall and he says, yes, you called. Essentially, I'm here to do what you asked. And he says, I did not call you. Go back to bed. So Samuel goes back to bed, and he hears the Lord call his name again. He gets up again. He goes to Eli, and he says, you called. And he says, I didn't call. Go back to bed. And so he goes back to bed. It happens a third time. He goes to Eli, and Eli finally realizes what's going on. And he says, listen, essentially he says, tell the Lord to speak to you. I mean, tell him that I'm listening, and I want to hear what you have to say. So we see that kind of wrap up in this chapter 3, and I'll start at verse... So it says, and Eli said to Samuel, go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you shall say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Then the Lord came and stood and called as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. And then it says Samuel basically got this message and he went back to sleep. I mean, can you imagine if you got that message about the person that you were, faithful and reporting to, what you would do? He goes back to sleep. I would imagine he probably didn't sleep very well. So he wakes up the next morning, and Eli actually asked him, by the way, what did you hear? And he doesn't want to tell him. So he finally says, you need to tell me. And Samuel tells him. and in verse 15, it wraps up. Verse 18. So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him, and he said, it is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him. So at least from that point of view, Eli was resigned to whatever the Lord would do. So Samuel does speak this judgment to Eli, and then the rest of the chapter talks about Samuel continuing to grow in God. Chapter 4, what we see here is essentially the Philistines come and confront the Israelites. In battle, and they beat them, the sense here is that they beat them pretty badly, and so the Israelites say, what can we do? What is it that we can do to cause us to win? And essentially, they say, let's get the Ark of the Covenant. This is signifies the presence of the Lord. He'll go out before us, and he'll fight those battles before us. So they bring the Ark of the Lord into the camp, and so. let me just read actually verse 3. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Next line, let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And then it goes on. They didn't bother to wait to answer that question. they asked a question, but they didn't really wait to try to understand the answer to open up their hearts before the Lord and hear what the Lord would tell them. They just decided, no, we're going to go, and we're going to go get the Ark of the Covenant. So this, as I noted here, an unanswered question leads to an unwise plan. When they bring the Ark into the camp in verses 6 through 9, they yell and are, you know, thrilled that the Ark of the Covenant now is going to lead them. But it has unintended consequences. The Philistines get their back even more up and say, you know, we can't let what happened to the Egyptians happen to us. So let's go attack the Israelites. And they, in fact, not only defeat the Israelites, even worse, but they take the Ark of the Covenant. They capture the Ark of the Covenant and take it with them. So this leads to disastrous results in verses 10 through 22. 30,000 die, the Ark is taken, and Hophni and Phinehas perish in this battle. Eli hears the news in verses 12 through 18. Eli hears the news and perishes. He actually falls off a wall and breaks his neck by landing on his head on his neck. And then Phinehas' wife hears about what has happened and dies in childbirth. So obviously disastrous results that come as a result of that. So just going to wrap up these next couple chapters really quickly. The supremacy, the Philistines bring back the Ark of the Covenant and place it before their god Dagon, but Dagon in two separate instances is essentially judged. And so what you see is that Yahweh shows his supremacy, that's your blank, there, over Dagon to both the Philistines and to the Israelites. Additionally, in chapter 5, verse 6 through chapter 6, 16, we also see the severity of Yahweh as the Philistine cities of Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron are judged. And over a several-month period, finally the Philistines put together a plan to send it back with an offering of some gold items that match in some ways either their gods or the things that had been happening to them, like there were gold tumors they actually made and put with the ark. And they send away the ark. And then we see finally the sanctity of Yahweh in chapter 6, verse 13 through 21, because as it gets back into Israelite territory, the people who find it don't treat it the way they should. In fact, they look into the Ark of the Covenant, and God judges them as well. Finally, Samuel in chapter 7 leads the Israelites in how that they can in fact be ready, and it winds up again with our memory verse that is on your question and answer sheets, that they should prepare themselves for God's mercy. They should have the experience of God's mercy. And then finally, they set up marker stones as a memory of God's mercy. And then verses 15 and 16 just sum up chapter 7. So that is 16 chapters. That's an awful lot to cover, but hopefully you are going to be able to remember some of that and pull it into the other lessons that we'll study as we go forward. So let me close in prayer. Father, thank you that there are so many examples in your word, Lord, how you are an immanent God, that you are a God who is with us, who is there, and who is faithful, Father, to bring us through both good times and bad. Lord, I pray that each one of us, as we study these lessons, would focus on the fact that you are a faithful God, Lord, that no matter what we're facing right now, Father, you are there. As we are faithful to you, especially, Father, you are there. I pray we would turn to you, Father, that we would hold tight, grasp tighter and tighter as we go through harder things, Father. Lord, and know and acknowledge and believe, Father, that you are holy and that you love us, Father. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.